My name is Ricky Day, and this is Nothing to Lose But Yourself. What's going on, everybody? What is going on? Yo, I miss y'all. I know you mad at me. It's been 2 weeks and it's been too long, and I miss you as much as you miss me, or at least as much as I'd like to believe in my mind and my soul that you miss me. I certainly missed you. What's up? My name is Ricky Day, and once again, this is a podcast, Nothing to Lose But Yourself, where we endeavor to make the world a little bit better place, one conversation at a time. I have been away for a couple of weeks. The hiatus is coming. This one was not planned, but you know, Papa is a very, very busy and skilled professional filmmaker, television producer, and visual artist. And so I had photo shoots, and we were shooting, and I was producing a pilot for a docu-series that we shot here in Harlem over the last week or two, and some other amazing things going on that I will share in future conversations and future episodes. But just know that I am booked, blessed, and grateful to be busy, but I did indeed miss you, and I apologize for that little bit of a unplanned break, but it was absolutely unavoidable. But we will be wrapping up this first season over the next couple of weeks, and then taking a hiatus for the summer, and then coming back bigger and better than ever this fall. So you'll have all those previous episodes to take you through the summer, and a couple of little added bonuses from the first season that I'll be sharing a little bit later. But we'll be getting into that in the future. There's time to talk about that later. Right now, let's talk about what we are doing today. Well, today I'm excited to have a great guest on. It is Pride Month. Yes, LGBTQI plus Pride. And this month we are celebrating the pride in this community. And in this episode, we're going to talk to a member of the LGBTQI plus community. He is an author. He is a music professional. And he is also, like many of my guests have been, a good friend. But this is one of my closest friends in the whole world, Akeem Bryant. Akeem is the author of a new book called Stuck Pages, Volume 2, The Pleasure Principle. It's the second book in his trilogy of books. We're going to talk about music. We're going to talk about pride. We're going to talk about growing up in New Jersey. We're going to talk about mental health and therapy and thoughts of suicide. So there might be some triggers for those of you who have experienced those things, but understand that this is a loving and healing conversation between two good friends, a conversation like all of them, designed to give you the nuggets, the tidbits, the gems that are going to make your life a little bit easier to live, your journey a little bit easier to bear, and of course, hopefully, I hope to entertain and engage. So, if you haven't done so already, follow us on social media, Nothing to Lose But Yourself on Instagram and on Twitter. And that's Ricky Day on Instagram and on Twitter. You can also go to nothingtolosebutyourself.com, and you can like the podcast. You can review and rate it on Apple Podcasts. And you can also now donate to support the podcast. And I hope you do that, because this is coming out of my pocket. It takes a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of resources to do this well. And I endeavor to do just that for you. But enough of me talking. After I shut up, the next voice you will hear will, well, it'll be mine again, introducing our guest. But then we're going to get into a great conversation with my guest for today, author Akeem Bryant. Looking forward. Here we go. My guest today is a self-avowed music head who was born in East Orange, New Jersey. He's had a long career in music, working in radio, also for the digital cable network Music Choice, and currently serves as head of R&B programming at Pandora. He's also a talented writer who has written album reviews for SoulTracks.com, has written for The Source, The Advocate, and served as lifestyle editor at Blue Magazine. His first novel, Stuck Pages, was released in 2015 and well-received. He's back with the second book in the trilogy called Stuck Pages, Volume 2, The Pleasure Principle, which continues to follow the life of the protagonist, Quincy Simmons, as he navigates his discovery of self, which is now fraught with trust issues after falling in and out of love. Akeem Bryant is a talented, passionate, and almost most certainly authentic human being and person. He also happens to be one of my closest friends. Ladies and gentlemen, why don't you welcome to the podcast, Akeem Bryant. What's up, man? How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I am well. It's a beautiful spring, late spring, about to be summer day, and I'm not mad at it. I'm really proud of you. I'm really proud of you, bro, for leaning into your dreams, man, and writing this series of books after much time talking about it. Yes. Tell the listeners a little bit about the series, man, what the story is about and what are some of the key themes in the book. Actually, let's start with telling people about the title of the book, Stuck Pages. I have selfish reason for asking that, but where did that come from?
Yeah, the title came from our conversations in the past and, you know, me kind of, you know, going over different stories, you know, things that have happened to me in the past. And, you know, I think at different points in our friendship, I've revealed different parts of those stories and kind of, you know, this kind of levels to it. So yeah, it was a comment that you used to make all the time in terms of like, there you go with those stuck pages. And it's like, oh, it's like, there's the name of the series. Let's do it.
And that was a very, very wonderful soundbite kind of answer to the question. The bottom line for y'all who are listening is there's a good friend of mine, rest his soul, Leighton Smith. We used to call him Che, in Los Angeles, who's no longer with us. And, you know, we as human beings, as men, and certainly as gay men or men who love other men, have interesting lives and interesting experiences and adventures and journeys. And, you know, even your closest friends can, you know, save a little bit for themselves and hold back on those stories. And so we would quite often share our experiences when we share the parts we were comfortable sharing. But then in later weeks and months, other pieces of the story would kind of fall out of nowhere. And it's like, where the hell? Wait, there's some stuck pages of your story. You didn't tell me this part before or whatever. Yeah. And I brought that with me to New York when I moved here. And Akeem would often do the same thing. He'd tell me these great stories about his weekend and his exploits. And a few months later, critical information in said stories would later emerge. And I referred to those as stuck pages in the story. And that's exactly what he named the book. So anyway, that is my very small contribution to some wonderful, wonderful storytelling. So back to you, man, and back to the book. I'm really, again, I'm proud of you for leaning into your dreams. But tell people a little bit about the series and what the story is about and what the key themes are in the book.
But yeah, overall, it's the journey of a heartbreaker. I wanted to tell a different type of story when it comes to being gay. You know, I grew up on the Elin Harris, Eric Jerome Dickey type of storytelling. So I wanted to kind of take it in a little bit of a different direction, or, you know, also coming what came up in conversations with mutual friends is, you know, once you come out the closet, like what happens next? So that's where I came up with the whole concept of this journey of the main character being a heartbreaker, but then in the first book, you get a sense of who he was before he became that person. So it's essentially the prequel to him becoming the heartbreaker. The second book is essentially like him full on out here just recklessly breaking hearts left and right. And it's not just romantic hearts, you know. You know, we can, you know, family, there's friends, you know, there's a number of hearts that can be broken in the process of people just trying to find themselves and find what their passion is and what their purpose is going to be in life. And then the third book is largely based around forgiveness. So just kind of wrapping it all up as a full story of this main character, you know, who starts out one way based off of all of the experiences that he had growing up. He becomes something that he doesn't necessarily like. And then in the end, he makes the changes that he needs to make to be the person he truly wants to be.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty common story arc in terms of people's lived experiences, but in many ways not often dealt with in literature and or film or TV. You know, it reminds me of the journey that I discovered in a book called The Velvet Rage, which I think I shared with you years ago. It's a book by this psychologist, Dr. Alan Downs, PhD. It's called The Velvet Rage, Overcoming Growing Up Gay in a Straight Man's World. And the book kind of chronicles, you know, what it means for gay, transgender, bisexual, whomever, who's considered quote unquote alternative lifestyle people, when you start to understand that something about you is different and people may be judging you for it, we quickly start to compartmentalize who we are and hide parts of ourselves. And, you know, people make all these wonderful statements about, well, it's not anybody's business. I just want to be private. I'm not ashamed. It's bullshit, basically. If you're ashamed of something, you only hide things you're ashamed of, basically. Yeah. And you're ashamed of things because you think they're wrong. And then as human beings, we all need validation. So as you go out and search for validation that you get from your parents for being a good son, a good student or whatever, it's great, but it doesn't really validate you the way it normally should, because you know that you're hiding parts of yourself from the world. And next thing you know, you're addicted to validation and you try to get it through material things and chasing relationships and boys and girls and whatever it is you're into, and you're seeking validation for things outside of yourself, and it leads to a really toxic existence. And it sounds very much like Quincy, what Quincy experienced in the book. What made you write these books, and how much of you is actually in Quincy?
Yeah, a large part of it is loosely based off of my experiences in life. You know, I won't get specific about which parts are real and which parts aren't. But yeah, I you know, this is one of those situations where I kind of wrote the book that I wanted to read. You know, if I had basically like, what is the story I wish I had accessible to me while I was growing up that would have helped me grow as a person? So this is the story. So yeah, when you speak about the validation and seeking validation outside of yourself and out into the world. That's a lot of what, you know, Quincy Simmons, protagonist, is experiencing in this story. You know, he gets his dream job in the music industry. He is falling in and out of love continuously. You know, it's a whole lot of external stimuli that is affecting him on multiple levels. And it's having, those things are having the impact that they're having because he hasn't yet quite figured out who he wants to be, who he is, and how he wants to represent himself in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a journey that we all have to engage in. And that journey can be an unhealthy one or it could be a healthy one. It's always going to be fraught with ups and downs, but yeah, it definitely can be challenging. What seems to be resonating with people who read the book, the first book already? I know it's been very well received and successful, but what's resonating with people in the book?
Yeah. I mean, I think some of the obvious things are, you know, some of the relationship stuff, of course. You know, you experience Quincy going through his first relationship, his first love, getting his heart broken for the first time. You know, I think that stuff resonates a lot. But probably the one thing that I really didn't expect to resonate so well, there's a particular character who essentially does not go away. I guess you can kind of put him into the category of being a stalker. And I think that's something that I really didn't, you know, I included that piece of the story, you know, based off of my background in loving suspense and mystery and things like that. So that was the purpose of me putting in that particular character. But then, you know, I was hearing feedback from a few readers who were just like, yeah, I had a stalker at one point, and oh my God, I can't believe, you know, that happened to him in the story. Like, I had a similar situation, and it's something that, you know, we as gay men, it doesn't come up in conversation a lot. I think from my experience and all the conversations I've had, it seems like at least half of us have experienced a stalker on some level, just somebody who just would not relent and go away.
Yeah, people that can't take no for an answer. And it really, it's about that validation thing again. You know, their sense of self lies in your response to who they are and to their advances. And for those reasons, it can become very toxic, unhealthy, and make them not go away. You know, we had a recent conversation where I revealed that I've experienced that before. I've had a stalker. And it's really kind of a chilling situation to find yourself in. And as a Christian and as somebody who's studying theology, you know, I have empathy for people and where these things come from. But empathy doesn't change the fact that you got to protect yourself and be wary, because these things get very dark and can cause you physical harm at some point. So, yeah, that stalking thing is very real. And so is sexual assault, which you also touch on.
Yes. Yeah, which is also another, you know, difficult part to write about. You know, I've had my couple of experiences of, you know, physically having to stop someone from doing what they felt like they needed to do. So yeah, it's of course it's difficult to talk about, you know, even more difficult to write about, but is necessary because, you know, whatever, you know, to your point earlier too, you know, what you keep in private tends to be what you're ashamed of. Mm-hmm. And there should be no shame around these type of topics, because it's not the victim's fault for right. what happened to them. You know, they should be able to speak about it.
Absolutely. I think you have to speak about it in order to move to healing. And the crazy thing is that healing is not only for you, that healing is also for the perpetrator. You want people, I know for me, I want people in this world to be healed, because it makes the world a safer place for all of us. There are people with very serious issues. And quite often they're issues that society helped to create in the first place. So instead of judging people and looking at them like the pariahs that in many ways they are, I think it's about being loving and finding ways to fix people where it's possible to fix them and to deal with these issues and figure out what in our society, what in our culture, what in our upbringing, what in the way that we interact with each other is creating these desires and situations to begin with. I don't think most people are born bad or yeah. quote unquote crazy, which is not a clinical term, obviously, or any of those things. But many of the things that we support and celebrate in our society leads to these behaviors and thought processes and brokenness in people that leads to so many of these things. Now, the second volume just hit the streets. I know that process for writing a second book is probably a little different than the process for writing the first book. My question is, was it always intended to be a trilogy? And then what was it like to write the second book? How did it differ versus writing the first one?
Yes, it was intended to always be a trilogy. You know, to kind of plan things out from the start in terms of the entire story I wanted to tell. Second book process was a lot different than the first. I'm actually toward the end of writing the third book now. But yeah, it's... So what I wanted to do was just include some of my experiences and have it resonate on that level, because, you know, some of this stuff is real. But what I did not necessarily set out to do is chronicle my journey, my growth as a person. And I've definitely have done that with this series, with the second book. That kind of represents me in probably my 30s, in that space of looking for, you know, fulfillment, looking for, you know, it's called the pleasure principle, looking for the pleasure, looking for all of the good stuff to come out of life and push all of the negative stuff and everything that I, you know, don't want to deal with to the side. And in the process, at some point you hit a wall and realize like you can't ignore the bad, things, you have to give them probably just as much, if not more, attention than the good things, because it's that balance in life. So yeah, there was, and then also too, what was interesting is there was some manifesting going on mm-hmm. when it came to writing with the first book. Certain people just started popping up that were similar to the characters that I was writing. It was a little eerie, and you know, I got into a relationship with a character who has the same name of one of the characters in the second book, and that was a bit eerie. You know, it's just like, what part of God is in this process that's you know, pointing me in these directions and really kind of forcing me to face myself and my decisions and those around me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you mentioned the title of the second book, and I want to dive into that a little bit. The second volume is called Stuck Pages, Volume 2, The Pleasure Principle. And I know, like, the chapters in the books, it's a song title, Janet Jackson's The Pleasure Principle. But it's also based on Sigmund Freud's theory of the same title. I want to share with my listeners a little bit about what Freud meant, and then I want to dive into that a little deeper with you. In Freud's psychoanalytic theory of personality, the pleasure principle is the driving force of the id that seeks immediate gratification of all needs, wants, and urges. In other words, the pleasure principle strives to fulfill our basic and primitive urges, including hunger, thirst, anger, and sex. When these needs are not met, the result may be a state of anxiety or tension. Sometimes referred to as the pleasure-pain principle, this motivating force helps drive behavior, but it also wants instant satisfaction. As you might imagine, some needs simply cannot be met in the moment we feel them. And if we're satisfied with our every whim whenever we felt hunger or thirst, we might find ourselves behaving in ways that are not appropriate for that given moment. A lot of childlike behavior comes out of moving and operating fully in the pleasure principle. What came first? The Janet Jackson song title popped into your head, or your understanding of Sigmund Freud, and how does that connect to what Quincy's going through in the second book, man, and what you've gone through in life?
Yeah. Me being the music head that I am, definitely the song came first. And so I dug into the lyrics and did some research online and found Sigmund Freud theory and dug into that. And then I was just like, if this is not the perfect scenario, kind of, mm-hmm. Which helped me understand that I was going in the right direction. And also too, once I got to the second book is when I started to really realize the mental health journey of it all. Then even just on the personal level, just understanding what the pleasure principle theory is about, how it drives people, especially regarding to sex, especially us, you know, being Black gay men who tend to be a little hypersexual, understanding kind of what plays into that.
Mm-hmm. And I push back on that a little bit, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's this thing where people presume that gay men and Black gay men in particular are hypersexual or more sexual than anyone else. And I don't believe that that's true. I do believe, however, that men generally, we're programmed on a genetic level to help the species survive by reproducing, spreading our seed as far and wide as possible. And in heterosexual relationships and community, what really kind of helps to balance that out and slow that down is women. Women come with slightly different agendas and needs. Yes, they are fully whole individuals and souls, and they have sexual desires as well. But they also, I think, on some level, are programmed with these desires to be nurturing and caring and some of those things that may, people try to say it's sexist or whatever. And I don't think it's necessarily that. I think we have to really, we forget sometimes that we are mammals and that we are encoded in DNA through evolution that has a lot of things in us. And fundamental of any living creature is that you want your species to stay alive. And so I think, you know, women kind of bring some balance to the equation in the straight world that, and yeah, in the gay world, there's nobody to pump the brakes. So if the attraction is there and mutual, there is no stopping it. And so we may fulfill the desires more often, but I don't think the desires are more readily present in us than it is in anyone else. I mean, I don't know what your thoughts are about that, but that's what I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get your point. But I also think when I say hypersexual, I'm kind of speaking generally and kind of, you know, speaking about the entire population. And when you're looking at other groups like women, when you're looking at, yeah, I think particularly there's just the difference between men and women. And then, you know, to your same point, you know, when you're dealing in the gay community, when there's nothing but men, there's no one to stop us. There's no one to level set and check us to say, hey, maybe you should think about that before you go and hop into the bed with that person real quick. Like, mm-hmm. like, especially when you're young. You know, this character is in their, you know, early 20s, fresh out of college. And that's the period that I really wanted to stress because, you know, it's after he officially comes out of the closet. But then he has to kind of navigate how he's going to behave and perform, I guess, for, you know, for his family, for his friends. And then also within his community where, you know, he's a little bit of a, what's the word? A catch, I guess, mm-hmm. some level. Mm-hmm. So just having to navigate, you know, all of the attention that he gets by just being who he is. And
oh, the plight of the pretty.
No, no. No, I think, and especially at that age, I feel like so many of us, you know, I don't think it's just a pretty thing. I think it's a new thing. You know, so many of us, and, you know, we're in our early 20s before we officially start to spread our wings into our sexuality and really experience what it's like to be gay and date other men and things like that. And I think that's where, you know, it just gets very confusing in that space. Mm-hmm.
And you're figuring out how just to be human and be an adult, yeah. be an adult. And yeah, the 20s is tough because you make these really casual decisions, but you really don't know much of anything. Mm-hmm. And the decisions quite often lead in outcomes that affect you for the rest of your life. It can be a scary time, amazing time, but it can be a scary time. And I tell people all the time, I have no desire to be in my 20s ever again.
No, me either.
It's cute while you're there, but I'm good on going back.
I am not going back there. Like, that was young, dumb, and what is it? Full of what?
Yeah,
like,
full of something, which didn't stay full very often given the, yeah. Anyway. Now, also, you know, you mentioned to me in conversation that Fat Joe had a little something to do with the title of the second book or with the content of the second book. And you talked about the quote that he made about the music industry being run by gay mafia. And how did that influence the writing of the second book? How does that play into what you were writing in the second book?
Yeah, I came across that Fat Joe interview that he did back in 2011. You can find it on YouTube. It's, you know, he's making the comments about, you know, the music industry being run by the gay mafia, and it wasn't presented in a disparaging way. It was him just kind of advocating for people being who they are, you know, gay people being who they are. And, you know, there are a ton of gay people or, you know, people from the LGBTQ plus community in the industry. And yeah, there are a lot of us that are running things. But I thought it was interesting because it made me think about, what if that's really true? Like, what if that was the case? What if there was a gay mafia? And that's one of the themes that I explore in the second book, you know, where Quincy is propositioned to join this organization. And the purpose of the organization is to protect the community. So, you know, I spent a lot of time just developing the storyline and the plot to express, like, what would this experience be like if there actually was a gay mafia? So, mm-hmm.
So, you know, we talked about the book a little bit, and some of Quincy is you, and a lot of the book is experiences that you either had personally or you understood through friends' experiences. I think it's also important for people to get a sense of who you are as a person. So let's go back a little bit, man. Tell us a little bit about where you're from. Yeah, I know you were born in East Orange, New Jersey. What was childhood like, and what did it look like for you? What was growing up in East Orange and the rest of Jersey that you spent time in like, and who raised you? And give us a little bit of a picture of your childhood and what formed you.
I was probably like any other kid for the most part. Very jovial, you know, I used to run in the streets with my friends, the other kids who lived in the building, essentially raised by a single mom. Father had weekend visitation rights, so I would go, you know, travel to Jersey City with him to, you know, spend time with his, with, you know, that side of my family, cousins, uncles, aunts. Kind of that's where the breadth of my family experience was, because for my mother's side, you know, she just experienced a lot of abuse and rejection and stuff from her family. So there's always been a certain level of distance there between myself and her mm-hmm. side of the family. It's a distance that my three older brothers that, you know, she had before I came along, you know, it's like a 10-year difference between myself and my next brother in age. And yeah, so she kind of kept me away from a lot of what my older brothers went through regarding the family. So, you know, I have a completely different experience growing up than they did. So yeah, it was kind of just navigating all of this growing up, understanding what the different dynamics were in the family. And then I think once I started going to school is when kind of things started to shift and change a bit. I remember in the first grade is when I started to get teased for, you know, knowing all the answers to the questions that the teacher was asking. You know, being called a teacher's pet and getting that rejection from pretty much half of the class mm-hmm. and me realizing that that's not a position I wanted to be in. So I started to withdraw, started to go into my shell, probably stayed in my shell all the way through high school. Mother realized what was happening. You know, she tried to intervene as much as she could, got into therapy for a short period around the age of 15, 16. Of course, I'm speaking about depression and anxiety and all the stuff that I've... it's taken me a long time to get to a point of managing my mental health. I also spent a number of years hiding it. And, you know, I think a lot of people kind of viewed me as, you know, super private and, you know, you're not really going to get much out of him. And he doesn't say much. And it's like, not really, because everything was going on in my head. I just wasn't expressing it.
And when you say hiding, what were you hiding? You just mental health challenges? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I didn't speak about it. I didn't even acknowledge it to myself for the most part until about 10 years ago. You know, I just kind of moved forward and I'm a fighter. So I was just pushing through it, mm-hmm. pushing myself through it. But not actually taking the time to be graceful with myself and forgive myself and forgive others and let some of that weight go. Mm-hmm. I've been in therapy for the past about five. Has it been many years? No, it's only actually been about 2 years working through all of this baggage. The pandemic definitely brought up a lot. A lot that I, was forced to deal with. Otherwise, I would not be here talking to you right now. I'm still working through it too. So it's definitely a work in progress.
What does that mean? You wouldn't be here talking to me right now.
Dealing with the suicidal thoughts. Which is, again, not anything that I've ever truly discussed with anyone besides my therapist. You and I have had a conversation recently about it. But learning not to be ashamed of it. Because as long as you're ashamed of it, you can't heal it.
Well, that's absolutely the truth. And I mean, in fact, it's nothing to be ashamed of. I mean, the very term mental health means exactly that. You're in the mental part of our being as a human being. There's health that exists there. And like in your body, there are times when you're very healthy and you're balanced and you're in good health. And then there are other times when you're challenged. You can have the mental equivalent of a bad cold. You could have the mental equivalent of a chronic illness. It kind of stays around with you and lingers a little bit and might require a little bit of treatment or some conversation. You could have the mental equivalent of a very serious issue that keeps you out of society or makes you not want to live anymore. There's varying levels to mental health and the challenges that can emerge for us as human beings, but it's certainly nothing to be ashamed of. It's just a part of our journey and who we are. I think it's also something you touched on earlier when you're talking about childhood and kids starting to tease you for doing well in school. I was one of those kids. I'm a nerd. I'm so-called intelligent or whatever by nature or birth. Lucky me. Hooray, hooray. But I don't think I'm any better than anybody because I happen to enjoy learning or I'm smart or whatever that means. But I do think it's insidious and freaking irritating, when kids ridicule other kids who are actually trying to do well in school and do something better with their lives. And people don't understand or recognize, I think, how traumatic those kind of experiences can be, particularly at the stage of development in which so many of us experience them. That is a form of trauma, and it can damage who you are developing as a person. At the same time, I don't want to paint the people that do that with a broad brush, that they're so evil and so bad and so awful, because that's coming from somewhere in them too. And so it's tough, but I know as African Americans in particular, when you deal with the oppression of the society, when you deal with police brutality and all the kinds of things that we have to navigate as African Americans and specifically as African American boys who are turning into men, I think it's almost impossible for any of us to reach our adult years and not be in a space where we could benefit from some therapy and somebody to talk to and help work out some of these things. I had a psychologist on earlier in the season who talked about therapy from the point of view of the physician and what that looks like. Would you mind opening up a little bit and giving people a sense of what therapy is like as the recipient of therapy, what it really is? It's about, these conversations with a professional who can help you kind of navigate some of these concerns and issues in your life. Can you kind of explain to people and demystify a little bit what therapy feels like from the patient side of things?
Yeah, definitely. For me, therapy has been such a blessing. I think it is kind of, I think the perception of therapy, especially in the Black community, is just, it's wrong. I think it's really just about conversations, and it's really just about getting what's in your head out of your mouth to and expressing it to someone else who can help you navigate where it came from, what it's connected to, what it's rooted in. I think for me, that's been the biggest blessing about therapy in general. You know, you have someone who is dedicated to listening to your problems, listening to, you know, how bad your day was, who is not judging you in the process of you expressing all of this, and is going to give you some tools to navigate it better in the future. One of the things that I've learned in therapy is, you know, the brain is very, you know, it's the chemistry of the brain. It's, you know, when you grow up processing certain messages a certain way. And then it gets to a point where that process becomes second nature, and you just tend to automatically go there when you're triggered, and not realizing that you're triggered because of the process that has become second nature, and not because there's an actual threat. Mm. So one of the things my therapist has continued to explain to me, that it's about rewiring the brain so that you can have a different response to whatever your trigger is. And then you can create a whole new process for how you respond and how you treat it. And I know for me, it's been a process of deactivating my hyper alertness. You know, I think one of the things that we say as Black people all the time is, you know, if you stay ready, you ain't got to get ready. Mm-hmm. Like that has been kind of how I lived. And what happens is you wind up overreacting in situations where, you know, you're triggered and you're thinking things are about to go the same way they have gone in the past. But ultimately, today is today and it's a whole new situation. So it may not go that same way. Actually, most of the time it doesn't. And most of the time you actually don't know how it's going to turn out. So you kind of have to have some grace in the process until you get to that end point and the conclusion. And then you can have your response that is appropriate at that point. But yeah, it's just been me just really kind of dialing back. And when I'm feeling triggered, take a moment and have a thoughtful, honest response about how I'm feeling, as opposed to feeling attacked and then going on the attack.
You spoke a word, bro. and it resonates with me because I know it's true in my own experience and in being a Black man and navigating our community and the challenges that we face. And it also hit me because there's a sister that I've been in close interaction with over the past couple of years. And she's a prime example of that, and something that so many of us have seen in our lifetime where, you know, she went through some things when she was younger. She's gone through some things as an adult. She's gone through addiction and some other things. And so she's gone through a lot, survived that trauma, walks with that pain. And as a result, almost everything feels like an attack. And the most mundane conversation or small disagreement or misunderstanding about something leads to her blowing the heck up. And the problem with that is, while I am empathetic to where it comes from, and I completely understand where it comes from, it does not serve her or anyone else well. Because the first thing that happens is people recognize that in you, and ain't nobody got time to unpack the psychology of why you're that way. They just know that they don't want to be bothered with you. And I'm one of them. I do not want to deal with that. I do not want to deal with that kind of stress. If I say the sky is blue a little too hard, she's going to probably go off on me. Like, nobody's got time for that. I empathize with where it comes from, but nobody's got time for that. The second thing is, I watched the experience that she had. I happened to be there for, where there was a mix up in picking up something that she needed to pick up. And, you know, she got there to pick it up, and the thing, her name was there, and part of what she needed to pick up was there, but the other part wasn't there. But primarily the situation, and then she lost it. She went off, stormed out of the room, the works. What kind of happened was she presumed coming in something was going to be wrong. She had some problem getting into the space because it was a weekend and there's a sign on the door and it was a little confusing. She went around to one side, then she came back around to this side. She called me. I happened to be there. I was able to let her in. But once I let her in, instead of, okay, thanks. I appreciate you, brother. Okay, I'm going to do this now. We're going to do what we do. She wanted to relive the experience that she just went through with the people who were receiving her to give her the things that she come to pick up. So she's so in that, that they're now on edge and a little defensive. They hear her name. They look down. There's a name similar to hers next to her in the book because they're flustered by the energy that she's putting out about the thing that's already passed and is really irrelevant at this point. Now they make a mistake and say, well, we don't have this thing for you, which then causes her to go out, which causes her to go off, which then causes her to storm off and not get the thing that she came to pick up. Mm-hmm. 2 seconds later, I was able to unpack the whole situation of what happened, and it ultimately got resolved. But the thing that was brilliant is somebody who's very close to her, and I'm being vague because I don't want to share her identity, but somebody who's really close to her, like life partner close to her, said, you know, babe, I think you should think about how you react or overreact to things, because you overreact to things all the time and you create the outcome that you're afraid of by the way you're reacting before it gets presented. So I share that story as just another way to punctuate what you said, which is so important and why I think so many of us as African-Americans can benefit from therapy and understanding all the things that we've gone through and what they've caused us to do and be and how we move in the world so that we can create these different outcomes for ourselves. Because, you know, beyond the particular situation at the moment, you just don't understand how that stuff writes the rest of your story. You know what I mean? If something comes across my desk and there are two people that would be great for it, and she's one of them, I'm going to choose the other person to recommend because I don't want to be attached to the possibility or the probability that she's going to go the heck off and make me look. So how many opportunities, how many experiences, how many wonderful things are you blocking in your life by reacting in the same way with the same thought patterns and the same responses to different issues in the future? So absolutely, therapy is helpful. And I'm glad to hear that you're doing it. And I'm glad to hear that you're engaged. And I'm glad to know that you trust me enough to talk to me about it. Because, man, we can't lose you. You can't be taking your own life about some crap that for the most part probably doesn't even matter and quite often isn't even real, but it's very real on your mind, which makes it very real in your experience. So I'm grateful that you share it, and I'm also grateful you share it with the audience, because it's important for other people. Somebody's hearing this today who's going to have the courage to seek some assistance, to seek some help, because your courage and being honest and authentic about what you've been experiencing. So thank you. That silence might be a little water dripping up the eye, right? Okay. It's all good. This is black men loving each other, not sexually, not, this is brothers, man. This is brothers you guys are experiencing right now, loving each other. And I do love this brother. He's been a great friend. He's been like a brother. And I just want to see him continue to thrive, as I want to see all of us continue to thrive and to grow. And it means a lot to me. It's why I do the podcast, you know what I mean? Like, for us to understand who we are and to learn to embrace who we are and to live life as and to love our authentic selves. Because as I've said so many times, when you can love your authentic self, it reduces the probability or even possibility that you're going to seek to make yourself feel better about who you are by attacking and diminishing other people. I think that's what's at the core of what's wrong in the world. So many people, whether it's individually or as entire groups of people, are so insecure about who and what they are. They seek to feel better about who they are by diminishing, oppressing, discriminating against others. You know, non-black races do that to darker skinned people, and men do it to women, and gay men do it to trans folks. And I mean, it's enough's enough. We got to go inside and understand who we are and love and embrace ourselves as the authentic creation of God. And if you say you love God, then you have to love God's creation. If you love God's creation, you got to love yourself. You got to love other human beings. You got to love the planet. And that just makes life so much better for each of us. So again, it starts with understanding and embracing who you are, like you have, and starting to share that. So thank you.
Yeah. And I think also too, one of my biggest challenges in this journey, especially over the past year, has been about forgiveness. How do I express this? It's been, so one of the things that I've been fortunate enough of is knowing at a very early age who I was and who I wanted to be, how I wanted to represent myself in the world. The challenge with that has been facing all of the ridicule or judgment or rejection for being that person. When you're a child and you don't know how to be anything else, that has been my challenge. But I think also too, I think the biggest challenge just in general when it comes to mental health is knowing who you are, getting to that place of having enough confidence to be who you are, no matter what situation you're in, who else is in the room. It is who you are and who you're meant to be, and be that. And I don't think we give enough conversation to that level of confidence, and just how difficult it can be if you don't know actually who you are, or you're still questioning, you know, what your purpose is in life. And being able to just navigate all of that, I think is probably the most, to me, I would think is the most difficult thing. Because if I didn't have my center, my core, something that I think my mother helped to develop, because she saw at a very early age I was going into my shell and she forced me to come out. Just to think where I would be if I didn't have that impact, that influence on me at a very early age.
Yeah, that's profound, and God bless her for doing that. And what you talked about is real, but so many of us can't do that, aren't not in a position to do that, because society, full of its own insecurities and self-doubt and self-loathing, doesn't encourage or give people the tools to unpack and discover who they are and live life as their authentic selves, because it makes people feel good in their own self-loathing to diminish you and have you feel something less than love for yourself. But the great disservice that is it's a disservice to everyone, including those who diminish and oppress. The world is brighter when people are allowed to be who they were created to be. We were all created to live life. We were created to have gifts that come through us for the world and for other people. And, you know, people wax poetic about loving God and about loving Jesus and about loving Allah and about loving, you know, people wax poetic about the love of their idols and their gods, but very few people put that into action in their day-to-day life and their dealings with other human beings and self, to be quite honest. Quite often people are very violently opposed to self, and that comes out in their loathing and their need to desire to you know, demean and dominate others. And it's pathetic, it's toxic, and it's not only destroying us, but it's actually destroying the planet. Because
humanity.
Yeah. And not just humanity, but the planet itself, because that self-loathing sits at the heart of materialism and capitalism and all the things that are destroying the environment and the world that we live in. Let's get on a little bit lighter subject. Yes. Let's get back to music. You are a huge music fan, and that really drives the writing in the book, and it's driven your career. Tell me about the first time you realized you had fallen in love with music, and specifically with R&B.
I don't know if it was necessarily the first time, but it was kind of, I guess, the first year or two. Around the age of 7, 8, I would spend hours in front of my mother's stereo system. She had the whole vinyl setup, cassette, you know, the radio tuner. So she had a small stack of vinyl. She was very specific in the type of music she liked and what she would actually buy. So she maybe had all of 25 to 30 vinyl records. And Sade's The Sweetest Taboo. I must have played that one day or one week, maybe for that full year. Like, I would just back to back. I would just, and particularly the song Sweetest Taboo was one of my favorites at the time. And then she had Anita Baker. She had Luther Vandross, Freddie Jackson, pretty much, you know, the Quiet Storm type music. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I grew up on Quiet Storm radio. You know, I would call into WBLS back in the day when Wendy Williams was over there, kind of getting her start in radio. Yvonne Mobley, I would actually call in to speak to them on a regular basis. And yeah, I just have always loved music. My brother also was a DJ growing up. You know, he got to the point where he did have a spot on Kiss FM back in the day. And, you know, he would play at all the big clubs that were in Jersey, you know, Zanzibar and Club 88 and Peppermint Lounge and all these different spots back in Jersey that would broadcast on the radio as well. So, I got bit pretty early on when it comes to music, and I can't let it go.
What did music mean to you as a young person, and how did it help you navigate some of the trauma that you talked about, the mental health concerns, and you're coming to terms with who you were as a sexual being? How did music help you navigate those times?
Yeah, particularly it's old school R&B that, you know, they touched on a bunch of different topics. It wasn't just about love or fucking. It was like, it was, you know, I think about the Commodores, Zoom, or even, you know, Lionel Richie, some of his solo stuff with Love Will Find a Way and Love Will Conquer All. And just all of these songs that had a bigger meaning about love and life and self. And so a lot of those songs kind of helped shape how I thought about romantic love, how I thought about, you know, the love with my family, friends, type of person I wanted to be. I do think when it comes to romantic love, it kind of distorted my perception of what to expect from relationships. Once I got older, I'm like, this is not what the love songs used to sing about. What is going on here?
I had the same response and the same experience. It was the love songs and a combination of like romantic comedies. I'm like, hold up. This is not like the Doris Day movie I watched when I was a kid. This is what somebody lied, and I am mad. Who do I fight about this? But your answer is not lost on me. You know, Black music has been so instrumental in our surviving and even thriving in this oppressive, racist, crazy ass culture that we live in. And yeah, I said it. Critical race theory needs to be taught because it's the truth. Why y'all want to give us a holiday and deny the truth? I don't have time for it. But Mm-hmm. I digress. But black music has really kind of helped us, man, to survive and thrive in those times. And it really did give us a sense of a moral compass and how to deal with relationships and how to deal with all the moral implications of some of these relationships. It's amazing. I continue to love music and I continue to want to embrace and hear new things, but I am challenged.
Here we go.
By the perceptions around love and family and sexuality and all those kinds of things that I find missing in so much of what we're listening to today. If you and I were formed by the music we listen to, if you and I had a sense of, God, I'd love to fall in love one day and be a wonderful partner for somebody and grow old with them. If we were, those opinions and thoughts were formed by the music that we listen to, what the hell are we teaching our kids about love and family and society and responsibility and what they're listening to? I don't necessarily have a judgment. I just have a question.
I do have a judgment. I do not think it's accidental that the music landscape, especially for Black music, is the way it is today. I saw a shift happening at the early start of my career in the early 2000s, where the ownership was shifting. You know, we were no longer the ones in control of our destiny and our music and how it represented our culture. And we're still dealing with a lot of it to this day where, you know, we, you know, this, the music that comes out nowadays has to go through a number of channels before it's approved to be released. And those channels, I question. I question who is the one approving these decisions? Who are the ones saying that authentic, heartfelt, conscious music is no longer relevant? Like, I mean, you know, her just won a Grammy for her song, I Can't Breathe. And that is a song that should have been on many radio stations across the country, and it wasn't. So, like, who are making these decisions and why?
Yeah, profound question. And I don't know that either one of us can answer it, but I think it's certainly, I'm not a conspiracy theorist by nature, but,
yes.
And I think that's where I'll leave it, because that's all I actually have in terms of real information to work with. Now, music's also played, obviously, a big role in your professional journey. And now you're head of R&B programming at Pandora. What's that experience been like for you? And what are you able to do there to further embrace your love of R&B and to push the genre forward as best you can from your position?
Yeah, it's been a blessing, another dream, essentially, that I've been able to achieve in life, professionally, especially. This is actually the first time that I've been in control of exactly what is happening in the genre. You know, before I've had to report into people, and, you know, sometimes that's been a challenge in being on the same page, but now it's, you know, I'm in this space where I'm coming into my own, professionally, just on so many levels, as a person, on a personal level, just, and all of it is, I am just grateful. I'm literally giving all the glory to God, because it's not anything I would have projected, anything that I would have suspected in the past. But it's here and it's mine. And I want to make the most of it as I possibly can, just making space for people like myself, who have, you know, had a number of challenges in the industry. Yeah, it's one of the things that I've been able to do is, you know, over the past year after George Floyd was killed, you know, we've launched a Black Music Forever station, and that has, you know, accumulated over 1 million listeners at this point. And what it does is help to celebrate Black music. And to be honest, when I first created it, the company was had a little trepidation about calling out the fact that we're celebrating Black music and Black music only. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, after we went through the year that we had last year, that perspective has completely changed. And, you know, it led to me making the Billboard Pride list for 2021, which is kind of like one of the biggest achievements of my career. And yeah, so I'm just in a very fortunate space to make room for more people. You know, we have the Pride campaign going on right now. And one of the artists that I picked for our artist to watch for 2021, Azion, she signed to Virgin. She made the campaign, so she's going to be on the Billboard for Pride. And like, that's like stuff like that makes me very happy to do what it is I do.
Yeah, congratulations. And that's great. And when we think about our steps forward as a people, we always think about the icons and the major people who have, you know, done these very public things to be celebrated. But it's people like yourself, people that are doing the little things every day to push the music, the culture, our message of freedom and liberation, all of that forward. And so I commend you and I thank you for that. What's your, you know, personal kind of vision and hope for Black music going forward in the next several years, months, and even decades?
More ownership. I think we need to, and it's happening. These kids coming up are, they're a new breed. They are much more business conscious. They are asking more questions. They have access to more information. You know, they, even though, you know, of course, occasionally, you know, these artists will get signed who clearly has no clue what they're doing. But by and large, like when you look at a Lil Nas X, he's in control of his career from start to finish. And that's something that the new generation, the Gen Zs, are creating for themselves. And I think more of that is going to happen in the future. And, you know, you have like LeBron James starting his own entertainment company, and just more ownership in us. And it's essentially another wave of what happened in the 90s. You know, in the 90s, we had a ton of ownership and, you know, a ton of labels that we owned, and we were responsible for the content that was coming out of it. So I think we're going back into that phase, and I'm hoping that long term we maintain it, because once you give it up, it's very hard to get it back.
Yeah, I agree. I think ownership is critical. I just hope that ownership comes with a return to some sense of a moral compass and some kind of true love for, us as a people, African Americans, I'm speaking of us as a species, human beings, and we don't not just focused on being capitalist and materialist and making money, but that ownership also results in us making a difference, helping us to see ourselves in a different light, helping us to come up out of the things that we've been dealing with, and honestly, helping our oppressors to see how what they're doing to us actually harms them, and if we just open up and allow people to be themselves, love themselves, embrace themselves, and stimulate ourselves with art and creativity, that we can and will live up to our full potential once and for all. Same kind of thing, man, in terms of my question about writing and authorship and books. Where would you like to see that go, and where do you see your own career going?
Yeah, just to continue to grow, just to attract more readers. It's really important for me to get this story out. There are so many nuances to the story that I would love to, I think would help just so many people, you know, so many kids coming up who, you know, were like us and who are like us. And so my goal is just to continue to grow. I do have an event coming up soon this summer at the Ollie Forney Center, which is, you know, homeless shelter for LGBTQ youth. Like, that type of work is the work that resonates the most with me. And I want to do more stuff like it and just reach the people and get the message across that we're all a lot more alike than we are different, especially in our experiences. And I think it's the isolation that people feel in their experiences that keeps them in those experiences. So, yeah.
I know a big part of their readership base for your books is actually Black women. What do you want Black women to know about us as queer men that you think they may not know right now?
I think it's also we're more alike than we are different. My stepmom gave me the best compliment of all, where, you know, she is a very devout Christian. She, in her, I think, early 70s at this point, she read it and she loved it and said that, you know, it changed her perspective on what it means to be gay. And I think that if I can continue to do that for a number of women who may not completely understand what it's like to fall in love with another man, then for me, that's one of the biggest things that I've gotten out of it. So,
yeah, that's great. That's good stuff. And I remain baffled by people that think it's a choice, that we literally wake up one day and like, oh, I'd love to fall in love with another man and be ridiculed and all the other things that come along with it. Yeah, that looks like a good time. Hell out of here with that foolishness. Are y'all crazy? It's, you know, it's not lost on me that it is Pride Month, and when this drops, it will be Pride Week. What does Pride mean to you?
Pride Month to me, and Pride in general, is just all about being who you are in spite of whatever situation you're in. I said this early on in our conversation that's one of my the battles that I'm going to be fighting going forward is just to be comfortable in my own skin in spite of what situation I'm in or who I'm around. Because all of that exterior stuff it really doesn't matter. It's what's going on inside, what's in my heart, what's in my head. Making sure that I'm comfortable with that. And that's where I think the pride comes from.
Yeah. Right. And man, to wrap this up, man, you've overcome a lot. You've overcome personal trauma. You've a gay man working in music, and you had to navigate that. You've written your first novel, now second novel. You've achieved a lot in your relatively short amount of time on this planet and being a same gender loving human being in the process. Leave us with this, man. What do you experience this world that we're currently living in as, and what do you say to the queer kid, or actually any kid growing up now, about the world you'd like to see them being able to inhabit and how to navigate it for themselves? What's your message of hope and perseverance for young people as they come up in the struggle now, obviously using your own experiences to guide that?
So one of the things that I've gotten out of therapy is how resilient I've been in life. And I think acknowledging that in each of us, just how we're, you know, we've all have gone through, you know, a certain number of trauma, and just being able to come out of it a little bit of a better person. I actually am very hopeful for the next generation, for the next two generations and generations after that, because, you know, they've grown up on the internet, you know, something that I didn't necessarily have growing up. They're growing up a lot more connected to each other's experiences than ever before. And I think that is going to help them become better leaders than the ones we have now, who are very much about self. And I think, yeah, I think that, and I see it in the music. I see the impact in the music. You know, again, there are a ton. I'm right now at the moment dealing with about 5 to 6 openly gay artists in mainstream R&B, and they're actually breaking in. And that's something that is not, I don't think anybody ever thought would happen at all. So to see it happening and to be on the front lines of helping it to, you know, become bigger and just better and grow is, that's something that I'm, that's a feather in my cap that I'm not gonna lose, because yes, it's amazing what these next generations, I think, will do and how they will change the world.
That's amazing. Yeah. You know, going back to the pride piece, pride means a lot to me, but what I hope it means in the future is that we don't have to have pride celebrations.
Yes.
That we don't have to have Black History Month in the future, that we don't have to have Juneteenth celebrations in the future, that we don't have to have these celebrations, because we will have moved to a space where we embrace and love and celebrate each other for just being human.
Yes. Yes.
I want to thank you again, man, for joining me today. I hope our listeners have been blessed by the conversation and encouraged in the conversation in many ways, but certainly by understanding the value of therapy and moving forward and getting healing and getting somebody to talk to about the concerns that you face day to day. I hope that people are inspired by Akeem's resilience. And most importantly, I hope you go out and buy the book and read the book. Where can people find the book, Akeem?
Yeah, pretty much find it everywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple. It's also available internationally at this point now. I just found out this week. So, yes.
So the book is called Stuck Pages, and you want to drop your social media handles?
Yeah, Stuck Pages on Twitter, on IG. You can also go to stuckpages.com for, you know, full information about both books in the series. And yeah, great stuff.
All right. Well, I'm glad to be back. And what better way to come back than a conversation with my best friend? So, Akeem, thank you for joining us. You guys, until next week, be well. I'm grateful for that great conversation with a dynamic writer and music professional, Akeem Bryant. You know, when you listen to Akeem's story, when you think about Pride Month, when you think about what we're experiencing as humanity and really kind of have since our inception, it can make you sad, but it can also give you hope. And most importantly, you can find joy. How can you find joy? You can find joy by going inside and learning who you are and embracing who you are and loving you who you are as an authentic creation of God. But so many of us are not capable of doing that because so many others of us spend our time actively blocking people's ability and inclination to do just that, to go inside, to meet who they are authentically, and to embrace and love that true self. So many people do this insipid and really kind of just wrong thing based on their own lack of love of themselves, based on their own understanding of the dogmatic and often flawed teachings of some of the world's so-called great religions. Yes, I am a Christian. Yes, I am studying theology. Yes, I love God. I love Jesus. And I rely on the Holy Spirit to guide my steps. I'm also very clear about what it means to be a disciple. To be a Christian is to be a disciple of Jesus. To be a disciple means to embody and follow and share the teachings of the carpenter from Palestine, the Jew who taught us how to reimagine our relationship with God, The man who spent so little time judging and so much time teaching us simply how to love. You can't love God and not love God's creation. And loving God's creation means loving yourself. It means loving others, even those who you don't understand. It means loving plants and animals and the planet itself. It means simply loving God by loving all God's manifestations in the world. Now, I do not profess to understand everything. I don't understand why some of us act one way and others act another. I don't understand why some of us are straight and some of us are gay, or some have different gender expressions. I don't understand any of those things. But it does not stop me from loving. And it shouldn't stop you from loving either. It shouldn't stop you from loving yourself. It shouldn't stop you from loving other human beings. It shouldn't stop you from loving life and creation itself. That's what this podcast is about. That's what our journey through life should be about. And I truly believe that that's what can get us out of these horrible situations that we've gotten ourselves into. Because again, there's no need to diminish others if you embrace and love who you are. There's no need to worry about judging others, because if indeed judgment is coming, God will be the arbiter of that judgment, of that justice. Our job is to live the lives we were created to live, to love ourselves and each other with our whole hearts, and to be grateful for the very breath that's in our lungs and the life that flows through the blood in our body. Be grateful and love. Let God, let the universe, let the rest of creation figure out what it means, why it means, and how to judge it. Our job is just to live and to love and to serve each other with the gifts given to us by God. Akeem is a reminder of somebody who has overcome trauma, who has searched for self, learned to lean in and love and embrace self, and then share his gifts with the world in an effort to make the world a little bit better place through his work, through his writing, and his output. I encourage you to find your true self, to lean into who you are, and yes, to forgive those who haven't made it there yet and seek to oppress and diminish you. Yes, they need your love too. It doesn't mean you have to subject yourself to their abuse, but it does not free you from the command to love. Well, y'all, that's it for this episode. That is it for this week, and that is it for this day. I hope that this conversation blessed you. I hope that your week has been a good one, that your day is already an amazing one, and that no matter how that day is going, that you are grateful for the fact that you get to live it. So go out, love yourself, love your neighbor, love your enemy. Be proud of who you were made to be. Search for ways to be more of that, more loving, more joyful, more happy, more giving, and be of service to others. Think about it for a second. If you love life and you say you're grateful to God, what better way to show your gratitude than to do everything you can at the highest level of execution possible? With a great amount of happiness and joy and gratitude for the fact that you get to do it, and to do it in a way that brings glory to God's name and makes you feel good about being you. Just love. Just live. Just serve. All right? Can we make a deal? Can we do that? I will continue to be me. As a matter of fact, I intend to be even more of me than you've seen so far. And I know challenges are coming. I know haters will hate. I know attacks will come, but I don't care, because I love God. I love me. And yes, deeply, honestly, sincerely, I love you. And I do this for you. Nothing to Lose But Yourself is a weekly podcast available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and so many of the major platforms. You can find us on social media, Nothing to Lose But Yourself, on Instagram and on Twitter. And you can follow me, Ricky Day, R-I-C-K-Y-D-A-Y, on Instagram and Twitter as well. Please go to the website, www.nothingtolosebutyourself.com, and please click on that little donate button and support the podcast with whatever donation that you are able to give. And most importantly, continue to share the podcast with your friends, your family, your enemies, your frenemies, whoever will listen. Share the podcast far and wide. I appreciate you doing it, and I invite you to become a bigger and more active part of our community so that we can together continue our work to change the world and to make the world a little bit better, one conversation at a time. I love you. I missed you. And until next week, be blessed, be well, be loving. I'm out, y'all.